Here we are with a worldie. when I think about this guy, I think mastery of skill, presence, global respect, an all-time great of this strange, beautiful, wonderful game. And yet he sits here with two deeply washed-up club cricketers. And I still feel like he'd fit into a club cricket changing room really easily, like a glove that I would then ask for later. That I'd want to borrow. Some numbers, we should say some numbers up top.
Say the numbers.
104 tests, 414 poles at 23, 356 ODIs, 502 poles at 23, 257 first-class games, 1,042 poles at 21, a highest test score of 257 red. And no doubt, like that low laugh there, and no doubt he'd be unbelievable on both the circuit and the stretching circle, which we'll ask about in a second. He's got a book out. He's done it with another great, Gideon Haigh, and it's our distinct honour to welcome to the great cricketer, Wasim Akram. Wasim, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, guys, and good to meet you. Very nice introduction. I'm impressed. You've done your homework, boys.
When I say he'd be great on the circuit and in the stretching circle, do you know what I mean when I say that?
I'm getting to know the Aussie slang, but I'm not that far yet. But please explain.
Okay, well, I'm a little bit unsure about whether to do this because your wife's in the room now. But the circuit is just, you know, when you're going out. I mean, we're going to ask later. You've been on plenty of circuits with Imran Khan in King's Cross and stuff like
that. Circuit.
The circuit.
I have been.
Yeah.
Goes without saying.
Yes. But I want to say. And the stretching circle really is just the stories you tell before the game afterwards. Now, Wasim, 414 test wickets at 23, it all started for you when you were spotted on the streets, really, then singled out in the nets. Can you just walk us through that process before your first-class game?
I can do that, talk about that process with my eyes closed because I've been doing it for the last 1 week probably. I was like any other young kid in my part of the world from Lahore. Inner Lahore, you guys can't imagine what it's all about. It's just little gullies and all the houses next to each other. You can literally, I used to climb houses because I used to fly kites as well. So I used to climb houses almost a kilometer from house to house to house to house to house. So that sort of congested kind of area, but very lovely people. Very humble background, people from humble backgrounds. And they loved cricket. Every day we used to play cricket, either with my neighbor kids, my age, I'm talking about age 12, 13. I played every sport in school as well. I went to very good school, Cathedral School, two big churches, used to have a hymn book. But every sport was there. I was in basketball team, I was in table tennis team, athletics, and then of course cricket team. Soccer, I never liked that much. And hockey, I couldn't play, I realized, because I was a left-hander. So, we played on the streets of Mazang. And then I finished my school, I think, in 1983. And then you have about 3 to 4 months gap in between to find your colleges or give your resume to college. My resume was horrible. I just bare minimum passed. And obviously, I wanted to be go to good college. And I finally got into a good college because of my cricket skills. But coming back to how I grew up, and then suddenly I joined a club. Obviously, one of my neighbors in my gully saw me playing ex-first-class cricketer, Mr. Khalid Mahmood, thanks to him. He said, why don't you play with a cricket ball? I said, yeah, sure, I can play with a cricket ball, but I won't be able to afford 100 rupees a month to give it to my club. He said, don't worry, they won't charge you. So he took me on his bike for about 3 weeks to a month every day at 2:30 to introduce me to the club captain, Sadiq Khan, ex-first-class cricketer and international umpire. Eventually, he became, and then my fast bowling coach, Saud Khan, S-A-U-D, who was a fast bowler himself. The same time as Sarfaraz and Imran went on to play for Pakistan, he couldn't get a chance, so he started coaching. And I started playing club cricket. Every weekend, there was a 2 games, Saturday, Sunday, and unfortunately, club cricket is finished in Pakistan. Sad, because that was very inaugural, important part of cricketers to grow up. And then from there onwards, I started getting wickets in club games. And then in the same summer, there was a camp going in 1984. Then summer after, there were 100 kids invited by not kids, but youngsters invited by PCB. And I think my club pushed my name because I was getting wickets for my club. And suddenly I was there at the Gaddafi Stadium, walking first time on Gaddafi Stadium turf. And it was dream come true. And I went there for 4 days. Nobody knew who I was. I just stood at the back for 4 days. Nobody thrown me the ball. I got a bit, not depressed, but disappointed. So I came back to my club, asked my captain and a fast bowling coach, there's no point in me going because I'm standing there for 4 days. And there are 100 first-class cricketers, test cricketers were there as well. Like Ramiz Raja played one test, Mohsin Kamal played one test, and quite a few more. And my club captain, Sadiq Khan, said, don't worry, I'll speak to the camp commandant, who was an ex-test cricketer, Aga Sadat Ali, that he'll give you a ball tomorrow. So I, okay. So when the next day, getting dark a bit, so he threw me an old ball to last couple of batters were there. And I ran in and bowled, and for some odd reason, he got impressed. So the next morning I came, he threw me the new ball. Next afternoon, a new ball. And then starting with the new ball, I used to bowl these big in-swingers and those Pakistani rock-hard balls we just used to swing a lot. And then within 4 or 5 days, Javed Miadad was coming out, the great Javed Miadad, coming out of injury, I think. And New Zealand was meant to tour Pakistan in September, October. I don't remember the exact date. That was a long time ago. And he wanted some net bowlers at Gaddafi Stadium. So our camp was on one side, and obviously being a Pakistani captain, he's got the better nets on the other side. So my camp commandant said, why don't you go and bowl? And Javed Miadad, 4 or 5 of us, so I was one of them. I was like literally shaking at the time because I had Javed Miadad's poster. He was one of the best players in world cricket. And I used to watch him on television. And suddenly I was bowling at him. I just ran in, sprinted him. I've been told not to bowl bouncers in nets to Javed Miadad. I said, I won't do it. So some odd reason, Javed bhai got very impressed. And within a month or two, the camp got reduced to, I think, 50 players. And the next phase was in Karachi. So then, you know, my dad bought me a plane ticket to go to Karachi. Everybody else went on a train. And on that plane, Ramiz Raja obviously was there. A couple of first-class cricketers who were well off, they were on that plane. And obviously taught me how to wear a belt, a seat belt. And then for the first time on the plane. And then they also said, when the food comes, you have to pay. So I literally asked the hostess, I forgot that mention in my book, but I literally asked the hostess, how much money? He said, no, it's free. So they were taking the piss, as you call it, in Australian culture. And then we landed in Karachi. We were there for a month, stayed at Karachi Coaching Center. It's still there next to National Stadium, maybe in dire conditions now. And every day we used to practice in the morning, a couple of hours, training, bit of drilling. Great Khan Muhammad came and he joined as a camp commandant, ex-Pakistani test player. And within a month, we had games against each other. Everybody got impressed. I was loving it. 17 years old, never traveled outside Pakistan before. And within a month, there was New Zealand arrived and my name was in the squad to play first-class game against New Zealand. So hence, I think I arrived there and the manager of the team at the time, he gave me 3,000 rupees. That was a lot of money for me because my monthly, I think my dad used to give me 200 rupees a month. Those days, petrol was 4 rupees a liter or 2 rupees a liter. So it was a lot of money. I said, that's awesome. I haven't even played. I've got this money. And I played my first personal game. Javed dropped Sarfaraz Nawaz and Tahir Nakash and played me in that game. And I got 7 for 50 in my first day. It's my first-class game. I don't know how. Because I hardly knew the players who was playing against. I read their names in Urdu cricket magazines called Akhbari Watan. I knew Jeremy Coney. I knew Jeff Fowler. John Reid was getting a lot of runs, the left-hander. And rest, I didn't know who they were. And obviously, eventually, you got to know they were the greats of the game. And second inning, I got 2 for 50 as well. So 100 for 9 wickets in the first-class game. And within a month, even in that, when New Zealand were touring, I got picked up to play one-day cricket. My first one-day game was in Faisalabad against New Zealand. And it got reduced to 20 or 24 overs. And it was the last over. I think it was Javed probably wasn't playing. Maybe great Zaheer Abbas was the captain. So he gave me the last over to bowl. New Zealand needed 24 to win. Jeremy Coney was batting. And I got hit for four fours. I think three fours or four fours. And I was panicky because I didn't know how to bowl full. I was just bowling length. It was kind of a green top pitch. And we won the game eventually. I thought, okay, they're not going to pick me up again because I got hit for four fours. But within a month, team was going to New Zealand. And I was on that tour. Got picked up by the great man himself. And obviously credit to selectors. I think Shafkat Rana was one of the selectors. Haseeb Hasan was the chief selector, ex-test cricketer, who's no more. So yeah, I was on the plane first time traveling abroad to Pakistan.
And then after that, obviously after that international experience, then you started making the big money. And by that I mean English League cricket. because the year after that you were playing, I know you're playing in Newcastle and you're getting about 50 quid a week.
Yes.
But then you sort of came full circle because in 1999 you're playing in Birmingham for Smethwick CC.
Yeah, there was a lot more money there though.
Right. Now, at that stage, you were playing league cricket. You'd already had 300 test wickets. You'd had 300 ODI wickets. And you played for them 6 days after the 1999 World Cup final.
Yeah.
So I guess what I want to know is, like, do you think we need to fix the scheduling?
Because I think that World Cup finished by midsummer, the 99 World
right.
Cup, where we lost the finals, and Pakistani still thinks that it was fixed by one guy.
Right.
Bizarre. I had a place in Manchester. My boys were, I think, Temur was only, I only had one boy, Temur, who was two years old. And I said, okay, only playing one game a weekend, or two games Saturday, Sunday, you know, good income. So 5 days at family and then play two games at Smithwick. But it was tough playing cup cricket again. Yeah. Because everybody expected me to get runs and get wickets and I had to run in every ball. And after about, I think, a month, I said, that's it. I'm not playing anymore.
Club cricket can be depressing.
Yeah, we can agree.
Is it true you were earning more for them than you were for the Pakistan national team at the time?
Probably per game.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, at the time, I was one of the top players in the world.
Yeah.
There was no point going in for the sake of the love of the game.
Yeah.
Being a professional.
Yeah.
I lost love of the game a long time ago. But like so many other players, like England seemed to be a place where you grew up a bit as a man. You seemed to be encouraged by your great friend Imran Khan, who we'll ask about later. But you know, obviously there's going to be stories about you, you know, with, you know, scoring hundreds with 30-metre boundaries and then taking 8 for. but like, I'm not really that interested in that, to be honest. You know, we talked to so many people. We talked to Curtly Ambrose. He destroyed people in England as well. We expect that. But, like, talk to us about off the field. And in particular, can you tell us about the Tuxedo Princess?
Ah, the nightclub. That was a normal hangout for me. I was probably 20 in 1986 or maybe 19. Because Imran was my skipper. Imran said, why don't you play league cricket? I'll organize it through one of his friends in Birmingham, Masood Chishti. Asan Chishti, friend of mine's dad. And he organized me a contract at Burnup Field. At that age, money doesn't matter. You just want to play cricket. And I remember arriving in April in England at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, getting out of Heathrow with leather jacket and sunglasses on. And it was dark. I said, what the heck is going on? I'm in the wrong place. And then I took a train. My brother was studying in London at the time. And then I stayed with him for a night. And then next morning, they took me to the Victoria Station. And from there, I took a train to Durham.
Right. Yeah. A long train.
Yeah, a long train. But it was, for me, something very new, something exciting. And then they put me in a flat just across the river where this nightclub was, that on the boat. Big, huge ship. Princess is called?
Tuxedo Princess.
Yeah. I found out a lot of Pakistanis are playing league cricket there. Mohsin Kamal, my buddy. So we started to hang out together, started to live together. Mansoor Ali, quite a few cricketers. Mansoor Rana, beg your pardon. And quite a few cricketers are playing in that area, in Durham and area. So we used to hang out. I used to hang out with them. Mohsin and me used to be. Mohsin's got a big beard now. I hope he doesn't kill me. But yeah, I'm talking about 35 years ago. So Mohsin, everything will be okay. Don't worry. You'll be fine.
You'll be watching.
So yeah, we were there. Obviously, the nightclub wasn't open on Monday, Tuesdays, and we were bored on Monday, Tuesdays. And there was only, I realized there's only, you know, Saturday, Sunday game 5 days, you have nothing to do. Maybe practice on Tuesday, but being Dharam up north, most of the time it rained. So, but I enjoyed every bit of it. It was dark, it was cold, money was hardly there, but that doesn't matter. But I enjoyed playing for them. Boundary was 30 meters, got runs, got wickets, and yeah, I was very keen. Keen as mustard, as they say. But enjoyed it. Very fond memories of that particular experience in Dharam.
I want to keep focusing on off the field, not because it's like salacious, but because you've done so many interviews about this book and like your cricket is just so amazing. But so many people know it so well, and you've probably talked about, you know, so many, you know, moments and achievements and stuff like that. So I'm curious to like zoom in on, you know, playing with Imran Khan, not on the field, but off the field. You know, like the tales of Imran Khan in Australia when he was playing grade cricket, just legion, you know.
Unbelievable.
Like, what's it like to circuit with Imran Khan as a youngster when he's going out, like, with you in King's Cross? Can you just paint a picture?
Yeah. Because
a lot of people in Australia will be, they'll be salivating, wanting to know
so
what this
was like.
So they
put us, that hotel still exists, just before King's Cross, called Boulevard. It's still there, very much. I remember staying there. For me, it was fun. The whole team and Imran said, let's go to a nightclub.
With his
husky voice. I called him in my room. I said, yes, Skipper, I'm ready. I was like this. So went to a nightclub. Just when you enter King's Cross, I don't know, it's changed probably now. Right-hand side, there was a nightclub. Not on the main street, just before the main street. And he walked in and people recognized. And he ordered a pint of milk at the bar because he never drank in his life. So they got him a milk in a nightclub. That was bizarre. And then there was a queue of only girls to shake hand with Imran. And I just said, that's awesome. Being a 20-year-old dude coming from Lahore. And yeah, Imran, wherever he went, I mean, he had charisma. He could talk the talk, Oxford graduate. And plus, you know, if you... handsome, and you know, Imran Khan, one top all-rounder of the world, great performer as well, skipper of Pakistan team, not just in Australia, India, you talk about places you don't even, Guyana. So there was a test match in Guyana in 1988. Those days there was a rest day, remember? 3 day you play and then a rest day and then 2 day after. So the rest day, said me and Ijaz, he said, we're going for a trip. I said, yeah, sure. There was nothing to do in Guyana, by the way. I don't know about now, but then there was nothing to do. So he took us and one of his friends, she, a female, took us to the airport. And she had her own plane. So we sat on a private plane, about 45 minutes ride into a deserted island. There was a runway there. And apparently the island was owned by her dad, who was, I think, into a logging business.
Right.
So they went into chat into the house.
Just a chat. Just
and me and Ijaz just looked at each other. Me and Ijaz just looked at each other. I said, okay, what should we do now? We can't even go back to the hotel. We are on an island in the middle of South America. So we're literally South America, in the middle of it. And we found young guys, some worker there who knew who we were, who Imran was, obviously. We were too young. He said, you want to go on a boat? So we got a boat and we got some cold drinks in the boat. Maybe there was sandwich around there. And then we just started going on the river for about 7-8 hours. We came back. Imran was ready to go. And then we came back.
Just finished up.
I feel like he had a certain glint in the eye, Imran, you know, like even... Just looking at some of your numbers, your first test 100 was in Australia, right? It was Adelaide.
Yes.
And you and Imran both scored hundreds.
Yeah,
and of course,
did.
You took 5 wickets in the first innings as well. But you scored 100 batting at 8, and he might have been 5 or 6 or something
six,
like that.
6, I think he was
right.
At.
And I was just looking at the score, and I was like, oh, Imran was in batting at Adelaide Oval just in the midst of hundreds. Like, there would have been something. Like, just in between overs, like, chatting, like, were you talking about the game, or were you thinking, like, let's just get to the end of the day and then...
Imran just said, don't play cross Peter Sleep. I think Peter Taylor, the off-spinner.
Yeah.
And after my 51st, I hit him towards mid-wicket for a big 6 and he came back to me and gave me that stare. I told you not to do it. I said, he was just there. He said, you're going to get out. And he wanted me to get 100, obviously, to save test match. And he said, play with the straight bat. But usually we're talking about the game itself.
Yeah.
And after the game, I remember when he came back, it was a big day for me. First 100, that too, with my skipper who's got 100 at the other end. He called me into his room, come to my room. I said, sure. And I went up to his room. He said, celebrate. I said, okay, how?
He said,
get a cold drink from that fridge. That was a big deal, getting a cold drink out of his fridge. So then we celebrated with a cold drink. And then he went out for dinner. And going out with Imran was always fun. Yeah. I mean, like I said, wherever I went, he had good friends and, you know, top-notch people. In India 87, we toured. Pakistan team landed in Mumbai. The team, after a couple of days, team went to play a three-day game. I thought, I'll be going with the team. Then Imran said, no, you're staying in Bombay. I said, what? Hang on a minute, that doesn't sound right. You can't question Imran. And he said, no, we are training here. Let the team go play a three-day game. So we trained in Bombay for 3 days. He was staying at his friend, Parmeshwar Godrej, one of the biggest industrial family in Pakistan. Unfortunately, she's no more. And I remember she had a massive house, still massive house, right on the sea in Juhu, very affluent area in Bombay. And I was in Taj in the city. And he used to send me a car and used to go there every evening. And, you know, we grew up on Bollywood. In Pakistan, there used to be one black and white channel. And we used to get, I think in Punjab, we used to get their songs. And obviously, those days, VCR came out. I know it feels that I'm very old, but probably am. So we used to watch those Indian movies. And all these actresses used to come and meet Imran. Imran used to sit there with his cold drink. And they all used to just sit around Imran. And I used to sit. I just used to sit there and watch everyone watching him run.
Is it true you pretty much ended Viv Richards' career with a bouncer?
That's what Viv tells me now. But guys, we talk about nowadays, we talk about top five, Virat Kohli, Smith, Babar Azam, you know, Joe Root, all these greats, modern greats. But that guy was something totally different. He has the charisma, the way he was, no helmet. I mean, he smashed me all around in the beginning, but I was very young. But he smashed everyone, not just me. Thompson, Lilly, great Imran Khan, Ian Botham, Sir Richard Headley. You know, all of Malcolm Marshall. I mean, no, he played for him. Played with his team.
In the Nets.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. But that guy was the whole package. I mean, the way he was, the way he walked, the way he batted. I haven't seen anybody like him as far as the whole package concerned as a batter.
I know you're saying something nice about him there, but like when you did whiz one past his head as well,
I think in Hobart.
Yeah.
And obviously it was a no ball. I think I played 356 one day as no ball. Short bouncer was a no ball. I don't know who came up with that stupid rule. Imagine on slow Pakistani subcontinent pitches, front foot just smashed them anywhere, everywhere. So I'm glad bouncer is back in one day cricket. But 351 days without a bouncer is kind of, especially on subcontinent, because it wasn't fun. Because being a fast bowler, at least you were allowed to bowl one bouncer. But yeah, that was at Hobart. And I saw the clipping. I think I tweeted about it as well about six, 8 months ago. And Viv said he told me, straight after, but he told me about 5 years ago, he comes to Pakistan regularly. He's the mentor of Kota Gladiators in Pakistan Super League. So he's there for a month. And what a guy. I mean, he said, Waz, thank God to the bouncer that I realized that this is time to go. So coming from the greatest of all time is a huge deal for me.
You played against like some of the best ever Australian teams, like sort of the team that Pez and I grew up in the late 90s. That was like the team, right? Now, did they abuse you at the beginning or did you sort of get their respect in the end?
They probably did. But you see, my suggestion to Australians, young Australians, and even you guys are, if you're going to abuse from guy from subcontinent, go slow. That we'll be able to understand what you're saying. Yeah, we couldn't understand a word what they were saying. I remember I was batting with great Inzamamul Haq in Sydney. He got 196 test match. And Warnie and I think Glenn McGrath and Steve Waugh were having a go at him. I picked up an Aussie accent by then a bit.
Yeah.
And I went up to NZNZ. I said, don't get angry. because they're having a go at you. You say, really? I have no idea what they're saying.
They even seemed to sledge like when they were batting as well. I mean, there's obviously the famous one at Hobart with Justin Langer.
And yeah, then he apparently he fucking smashed it.
He fucking smashes it, right?
Yeah.
But you can hear it, like, remember live, like, I remember being about 12 or 13 or whatever, watching that, being like, whoa, he smashed that.
Yeah, I know. No, he sent me a message the other day through Gideon, I mean, who did a great job with this, one of the best people I've worked with, journalists I've worked with. He said, please tell Waz, fucking smashed it.
in Australia, like our dressing rooms at club cricket, like we're fascinated with bodies and with rigs.
Yeah.
You know, who you don't want to shower next to and all that kind of
yeah.
stuff. Can you paint a picture of like the Pakistani dressing room in the late 80s? Like, was there any sort of nude culture?
In Lancashire dressing room, when I joined the first time, we used to go in tracksuits in Pakistan team and come back in tracksuits and obviously have a shower. In our rooms when we, but in Lancashire, first time I went there, my jacket, my tie, my white shirt, my, you know, chinos were there. I said, hang on a minute, what's this? He said, you have to come every morning in this. That was a big deal for me and it was difficult.
Yeah.
But after the game, you have to have a bar shower there, communal shower. It was very new for me. And then put up your tie, jacket, and if you drink or don't drink, you go to the bar and have a drink if you want, pick up a cold drink and, you know, have chat with the opposition. Great culture it was. But first day, I remember then in Nottingham, they all just went freaking without any clothes. And I was looking at them being a 920-year-old, hang on a minute. I was shy. I said, that doesn't look very good. And then I went in to have a shower, obviously, but with my, you know, underpants on. And they made fun of me. After a month, I said, fuck it. Yeah. I just came off.
I know you've spoken extensively about your addiction with cocaine, and that's been a lot of takeaways from the book so far that's come out. I want to know what, and I understand you're sober now, so congratulations on your sobriety.
Yeah, thank you.
But I want to know how that started for you, because I know you are and were one of the most famous people in Asia, let alone Pakistan. But I believe it started in England.
Yeah, in England, at a party, somebody said, you want to try it? And I retired. I said, yeah, let's try it. And eventually, one line became a gram, and then I came back to Pakistan. Nobody knew what it was, but it was available. And every party, and then I realized I couldn't function without it. It means I couldn't go out and socialize without it. And it got worse and worse and worse. And obviously, I was hurting. My kids were very young. I was hurting my late wife a lot. And then she said, you need help. We had a lot of arguments. It's a long story, but yeah, it's all in the book. But yeah, and then I said, okay, what help I can get? She said, there's a rehab here. Why don't you go there? I said, okay, I'll go there for a month. Although they kept me for 2.5 months against my will. Apparently, that's illegal in the world, but not in Pakistan. And that didn't help me, actually. When I came out, I got that rebellion came into me that it was my money against my will. I stayed in that horrible place because I had an image of when you see Western movies, you see those rehabs, even in Australia, you know, beautiful lawns and people will give you lectures. You do go to a gym. And I went to a place with a corridor and 8 rooms. That's it. And it was very, very tough. It was a horrible time. And then obviously the tragedy with my wife when she passing away. And I had too much on my plate. And I wanted to get out of it. I wanted to get out of it because I knew I'm on the wrong path. When you know you're on the wrong path, but sometimes you need, I think the biggest sacrifice she did for me that, and then 2 young boys, 7 and 10. And, you know, in our culture as a dad, in Australia, Western culture, dad is involved 50-50, you know, wake up in the morning, if the kid is young, drop school, pick school, change clothes. We never do that. It's wife's turn and our job is to go and work and raise funds for the kids' money. And I was lost for 2 years. What to do, how to raise them. I never knew that you have to buy clothes. I never knew what they eat. I didn't know every class. I have to go to parent-teacher meetings. I have to be friendly with their friends' parents, play dates. And then I have to move city. But I believe, I must say, every parent around my kids, who were their friends, they really helped. where as much as they can, they help. They said, okay, bring the boy at my place and leave them for a couple of hours, take the other boy to their place. Then I moved to Karachi. That was a big deal as well. I moved with the two kids and this guy, Abbas, who worked with me for 20 years. I mean, credit to him. I think I wrote about him in the book in detail. He was a rock to me. Then I moved to Karachi because my in-laws were there. And renting a new house from scratch, lived in one bedroom at my wife's uncle's place, three or four of us, found a new school. And after 3-4 years, obviously, credit to Shanira, my wife now, she I introduced to her in Melbourne, and then she took over when we got married. But yeah, 2-3 years were very, very tough.
Yeah. The reason I don't want to harp on it, because I'm sure it's a very dark time in your life, but a lot of our audience are young people, and there's definitely an explosion of cocaine across the world now. And sure. I think a lot of people will really relate to what you said at the beginning there, where they felt like they need it. You know, they felt like they needed to socialize. Yeah.
In the beginning, you say, okay, a couple of lines, I'll be fine.
Right.
And then if you, every weekend you're doing it, a couple of lines go to 4 lines.
Right.
And then it goes. And I think my, I suppose, advice to this young generation is what matters is the company.
Mm.
If your company is like this, you're bound to get into it. Very few can get out of it. So make sure you're in the right company around you, people around you who have good work ethics. If your friends are doing bugger all or fuck all, then you'll be doing exactly the same way. So make sure your friends have good ethics. I'm not saying they should be rich. They should have at least a job, 9-to-5 job or whatever. But if a guy who's not doing anything all his life, how will he motivate you? How can he or she motivate you? This is that simple. That's what I've learned.
I was listening to an interview you did with Osman Samuddin from Crick Info about this book. And he opened by contrasting Western culture of speaking quite openly about problems with culture in Pakistan. I just wonder whether it's talking about addiction or tragedy or match fixing, which we haven't talked about, things that would be regarded as, you know, quite controversial and whatever, you know, how that experience has been for you putting it into the book. Has it been has it been cathartic? Has it helped you? Like, what's it been like putting a memoir together and putting all this stuff down?
Both a bit. It was daunting to revisit these incidents. And then I think now, once the book is out now, we haven't reached Pakistan yet, it will. But a chapter is closed and in our culture, we tend to hide things. That's the culture, not just Pakistan, subcontinent culture. You hide things like this. I remember when I got diagnosed as a diabetic, I wanted to come out with it. My wife, Huma, said yes. But all my people around me, no, don't come out with it. This will happen. The sponsors will run away. I said, if I can motivate diabetics worldwide, why should I hide? You know, in our part of the world, if a girl, unfortunately, is diabetic, people might not marry her. That's why they keep it quiet. They think if she's diabetic, the husband will get diabetic. Wrong. If she's diabetic, the kids will born diabetic. Wrong. So not without knowing, I'm all for culture, but as long as your culture evolves you. So this was tough to come out with it, but I'm glad I came out with it. And if at my age, what I've learned, if I haven't done anything wrong, if I'm not doing anything wrong, apart from Almighty, I'm not scared of anyone. I really don't care anymore.
Just reading parts of the extracts of the book, it's so interesting to learn more about the man behind the stories, because obviously like in our lifetime, you were the hero from Pakistan, you know. Sure. We got to see everything that you did, and it was actually a pleasure to like revisit. I was just on YouTube before, and I was searching you, and it's just fucking I wasn't. You really got the ball to talk.
There was, it needed to be said.
Yeah. I mean, there's four international hat tricks. You've got the equal record, two in tests, two in ODIs. I was going to ask you what your favourite hat trick was, but I also want to know what you guys were doing with the ball, because fuck, it swung a lot.
I can promise you guys, if I can make a reverse swing ball and give it to the present bowlers, they won't be able to swing both ways. One way, yes. For instance, look at the modern great fast bowler, Mitchell Starc. When he comes from around the wicket, with the old ball, he just bowls away swingers, good yorkers, but he never brings the ball back in from around the wicket. So it doesn't matter whatever we did with the ball, it's an art to swing the ball both ways. And that, as a bowler, I think one bowler who does it beautifully is from England, Anderson. with the new ball and with the reverse swing ball. He has mastered that art. But I think that art is dying now, unfortunately. Saliva is not allowed. Now it's allowed. Last month it came out, it's not allowed.
This month it came back,
it's allowed.
Yeah.
Who's making these decisions?
Yeah.
I mean, if for instance, when they said saliva is not allowed, and I said, hang on a minute. If you're playing in Melbourne on a cold day, for instance, and you don't sweat, how will you shine the ball? They don't think it through, do they, sometimes?
There's some fire behind that. Wasim, I'm very conscious that every time you speak, people who speak to you will probably want to take so much from you. And I feel like we haven't even scraped the surface, but I'm also very conscious of your time. You've been doing a lot of interviews. So we will wrap it up there and then probably hassle you at another point when you forget who we are and talk to you more about cricket. But just for people who are listening or watching, the book is called Sultan. And what a name. Sultan doesn't appear to have any one meaning. It's an Arabic word meaning sovereign strength, authority, power. When you touch the book, it's got such a beautiful feel. It's your spot lit in the picture. You're smiling, middle stumps out of the ground, your arms are aloft. And I think that's how a lot of Aussies...
Credit goes to my publishers.
Yes.
They did a lot of homework with the name, with my wife around and Gideon. And then, of course, they picked up this picture. So well done, Hardy Grant.
Yeah, I was going to say it's out through Hardy Grant in Australia and other everywhere else as well.
Yeah.
Anywhere Hardy Grant is putting books out. It's called Salt and Wasim Akram. It's been such a pleasure and a privilege for us to be able to speak to you.
No, thank I enjoyed you. It, guys. Thank you very much. Maybe next time we can chat about other things.